Chapter 4. The Case for the Prosecution. Because the 90-degree heat had already begun to take its toll, the Honorable Leonard Strickland Roan ordered the windows and doors thrown open when he convened the Leo Frank case in the temporary Atlanta courtroom on July 28, 1913, at 10 o'clock a.m. The 250 seats in the courtroom were packed full. Outside, crowds milled, spilling over onto Pryor and Hunter Streets. 20 officers guarded the courtroom. Judge Roan, an experienced and able jurist, who had served as the presiding judge in almost all of the murder trials in the Stone Mountain area, was determined that strict decorum would be observed inside his courtroom. Although various accounts tell that the words, quote, "hang the Jew," end quote, were shouted by the crowd outside, jurors, bailiffs, clerks, and court officials claimed that there were no disturbances or crowd noises until the verdict was announced. The jurors, all white men and Atlanta residents, were chosen within 3 hours of the first morning of the trial. 144 people were drawn. 54 were excused. 37 because they confessed an already formed opinion. 3 because they were over 60. 14 because they opposed capital punishment. The defense used 18 of its 20 strikes without a cause, while the prosecution used 7 of the 10 it was allowed. The 12 men chosen were C.J. Basshart, pressman, A.H. Hensley, head salesman, buggy company, J.F. Higdon, building contractor, W.N. Jeffries, real estate, M. Johenning, shipping clerk, W.F. Medcalf, mailer, J.T. Osborne, optician, Frederick V.L. Smith, paying teller, D. Townsend, paying teller, F.E. Windburn, railroad claims agent, A.L. Wisby, cashier, M.S. Woodward, cashier, King Hardware. They were lodged at the old Kimball House and not allowed to read the newspapers or talk with their families concerning the trial. The chief prosecutor, Solicitor General Hugh A. Dorsey, according to the newspapers, was handsome and forceful. At 42, he was Solicitor General for the Fulton County Courts. Fully convinced of Frank's guilt, he was assisted by Frank Arthur Hooper, a successful corporate attorney who had volunteered his services, and Edward A. Stevens, Assistant Solicitor General. Leo Frank was defended by Atlanta's two well-known trial lawyers. Luther Z. Rosser, who, according to the Atlanta Constitution, was the, quote, "most persuasive and most domineering lawyer in Atlanta in the art of examining witnesses," end quote, and Reuben Arnold, quote, "best known attorney in Georgia," end quote, and, quote, "one of the ablest criminal lawyers in the South," end quote, according to the Atlanta Journal. They were assisted by Stiles Hopkins and Herbert Haas. In his opening argument for the prosecution, Special Assistant Solicitor Hooper described the state's case against Frank. According to his outline, Mary Fagan had died as a result of a premeditated rape by the defendant, Leo Frank. It was alleged that Frank had seduced and taken liberties with other young factory girls and had made unsuccessful advances to Mary Fagan. Several surviving family members have said that Frank harassed Mary Fagan and that she went home and told her mother. Several former National Pencil Company employees who are still living, but wish that their names not be disclosed, have also alleged that they heard Frank sexually harass Mary Fagan. According to the state, Frank expected Mary Fagan to come to the factory on the Saturday she died, because a fellow employee had asked Frank for Mary's pay envelope earlier, and he refused to give it to her. The state contended that Jim Conley had previously acted as a lookout for Frank, so Frank's immoral activities would not be discovered, and Frank had told Conley to work on April 26th. Assistant Solicitor Hooper then sketched in the state's contention that Frank was alone in the office, gave Mary Fagan her pay envelope, whereupon she asked him if the medal for her work had come. Saying he didn't know, Frank followed Mary to the medal room and made sexual overtures to her. She repulsed him, and he knocked her down, and while she was unconscious, raped her. Then, fearful of the consequences, he strangled her. Thereafter, he went up to the fourth floor to get the workers out of the building and called Conley, confessing, quote, that he guessed he had struck her too hard, end quote. With Conley, Frank dragged the body to the basement and made plans for Conley to burn it later. He gave Conley $2.50 and then $200, but later had Conley return the money, promising he would give it back to Conley after Conley disposed of the body. As Hooper went over the outline of the rest of the state's case, he singled out the expected testimony of Montine Stover, who he claimed would contradict Frank's contention that he had been in his office continuously from 12 o'clock p.m. to 12:45 p.m. Testimony began that Monday afternoon as Mrs. J.W. Coleman, Fanny Fagan Coleman, the mother of little Mary Fagan, testified. Dressed in a black morning dress and heavy veil, which she threw back, she spoke in a low voice, telling that she last saw her daughter alive on April 26, 1913, at their residence, 146 Lindsay Street, about 11:45, before Mary went to the pencil factory to get her pay. Tearfully, she described her daughter and the clothing she was wearing. A court officer drew forth a suitcase which had been hidden behind several chairs. Standing in front of the mother, he undid the satchel and lifted out the dress and shoes that Mary Fagan had worn when her mother last saw her. The officer first laid the dress upon the witness stand, almost under the mother's feet, and placed the shoes beside it. Everyone had leaned forward when the satchel had been brought from behind the chairs. Everyone, the lawyers, the audience, the jury, waited as the torn clothing and shoes were placed close to Mary's mother for her identification. After the most hurried glance at the clothing, which almost touched the hem of her dress, Mrs. Coleman covered her eyes with a palm fan and began to sob. This was how Fanny Fagan Coleman, without speaking, identified the clothing of her murdered daughter. At that time, few women attended a court trial except for those who were related either to the victim or to the defendant. Fanny Fagan Coleman and Ollie Mae Fagan, little Mary's sister, as well as her brothers, all attended the trial, as did Lucille Selig Frank, Frank's wife, and Mrs. Ray Frank, his mother. When asked for her thoughts by a reporter for the Atlanta Journal on the first day's proceedings of the trial, Fanny Fagan Coleman said, quote, "I would rather not talk about it. I don't want to express an opinion," end quote. It was this profession of silence which caused the rest of the Fagan family not to speak of the trial for the next 70 years. On that day, Ollie Mae Fagan agreed. Quote, "I'm like my mother in not wanting to talk about the trial. The trial is almost more than my mother can bear. She was the youngest of us, Mary, I mean. She was the life of our home. Now everything is different." End quote. Among the testimonies that proved especially damaging to Frank was that of Newt Lee, the night watchman who usually worked weekdays from 6 o'clock p.m. to 6 o'clock a.m., but on Saturdays began work at 5 o'clock p.m. He reported that on the Saturday of the murder, he got to the factory at 4 o'clock p.m. Quote, "On the 26th day of April, 1913, I was night watchman at the National Pencil Factory. I had been night watchman there for about 3 weeks. When I began working there, Mr. Frank carried me around and showed me everything that I would have to do. I would have to get there at 6 o'clock on weekdays, and on Saturday evenings, I have to come at 5 o'clock. On Friday, the 25th of April, he told me, quote, "Tomorrow is a holiday, and I want you to come back at 4 o'clock. I want to get off a little earlier than I have been getting off," end quote. "I got to the factory on Saturday about 3 or 4 minutes before 4. The front door was not locked. I pushed it open, went on in, and got to the double door there. I was paid off Friday night at 6 o'clock. It was put out that everybody would be paid off then. Every Saturday when I got off, he gives me the keys at 12 o'clock so that if he happened to be gone when I get back there at 5 or 6 o'clock, I could get in. And every Monday morning, I return the keys to him. The front door has always been unlocked on previous Saturday afternoons. After you go inside and come up about middle ways of the steps, there are some double doors there. It was locked on Saturday when I got there. Have never found it that way before. I took my key and unlocked it. When I got upstairs, I had a sack of bananas and I stood to the left of that desk like I do every Saturday. I says, like I always do, quote, "All right, Mr. Frank," end quote. And he come bustling out of his office. He had never done that before. He always called me when he wanted to tell me anything and said, quote, "Step here a minute, Newt," end quote. This time, he came up rubbing his hands and says, quote, "Newt, I am sorry that I had you come so soon. You could have been at home sleeping. I tell you what you do. You go out in town and have a good time," end quote. He had never let me off before that. I could have laid down there in the shipping room and gone to sleep, and I told him that. He says, quote, "You need to have a good time. You go downtown, stay an hour and a half, and come back your usual time at 6 o'clock. Be sure and be back at 6 o'clock. End quote. I then went out the door and stayed until about 4 minutes to 6. When I came back, the doors were unlocked just as I left them, and I went and says, quote, "All right, Mr. Frank," end quote. And he says, quote, "What time is it?" end quote. And I says, quote, "It lacks 2 minutes of 6, end quote. He says, quote, "Don't punch yet. There is a few work today and I want to change the slip," end quote. It took him twice as long this time than it did the other times I saw him fix it. He fumbled putting it in while I held the lever for him, and I think he made some remark about he was not used to putting it in. When Mr. Frank put the tape in, I punched and I went on downstairs. While I was down there, Mr. Gant came from across the street from the beer saloon and says, quote, "Newt, I got a pair of old shoes that I want to get upstairs to have fixed," end quote. I says, quote, "I ain't allowed to let anybody in here after 6 o'clock," end quote. About that time, Mr. Frank come busting out of the door and run into Gant unexpected, and he jumped back, frightened. Gant says, quote, "I got a pair of old shoes upstairs. Have you any objection to my getting them?" end quote. Frank says, quote, "I don't think they are up there. I think I saw the boys sweep some up in the trash the other day," end quote. Mr. Gant asked him what sort they were, and Mr. Frank says, quote, "Tans," end quote. Gant says, quote, "Well, I had a pair of black ones, too," end quote. Frank says, quote, "Well, I don't know," end quote. And he dropped his head down just so. Then he raised his head and says, quote, "Newt, go with him and stay with him and help him find them," end quote. And I went up there with Mr. Gant and found them in the shipping room, 2 pair, the tans and the black ones. Mr. Frank phoned me that night about an hour after he left. It was sometime after 7 o'clock. He says, quote, "How is everything?" end quote. And I says, quote, "Everything is all right so far as I know," end quote. And he says, quote, "Goodbye," end quote. No, he did not ask anything about Gant. Yes, that is the first time he ever phoned to me on a Saturday night. There is a light on the street floor just after you get in the entrance to the building. The light is right up here where that partition comes across. Mr. Frank told me when I first went there, quote, "Keep that light burning bright so the officers can see in when they pass by," end quote. It wasn't burning that day at all. I lit it at 6 o'clock myself. On Saturdays, I always lit it, but weekdays it would always be lit when I got there. On Saturdays, I always got there at 5 o'clock. This Saturday, he got me there an hour earlier and let me off later. There was a light in the basement down there at the foot of the ladder. He told me to keep that burning all the time. It has two little chains to it to turn on and turn off the gas. When I got there on making my rounds at 7 o'clock on the 26th of April, it was burning just as low as you could turn it, like a lightning bug. I left it Saturday morning burning bright. I made my rounds regularly every half hour Saturday night. I punched on the hour and punched on the half, and I made all my punches. The elevator doors on the street floor and office floor were closed when I got there on Saturday. They were fastened down just like we fasten them down every other night. When 3 o'clock came, I went down the basement, and when I went down and got ready to come back, I discovered the body there. I went down to the toilet, and when I got through, I looked at the dustbin back to the door to see how the door was, and it being dark, I picked up my lantern and went there, and I saw something laying there, which I thought some of the boys had put there to scare me. Then I walked a little piece towards it, and I seen what it was, and I got out of there. I got up the ladder and called up the police station. It was after 3 o'clock. I carried the officers down where I found the body. I tried to get Mr. Frank on the telephone and was still trying when the officers came. I guess I was trying about 8 minutes. I saw Mr. Frank Sunday morning at about 7 or 8 o'clock. He was coming in the office. He looked down on the floor and never spoke to me. He dropped his head right down this way. Mr. Frank was there and didn't say nothing while Mr. Darley was speaking to me. Boots Rogers, Chief Lanford, Darley, Mr. Frank, and I were there when they opened the clock. Mr. Frank opened the clock and said, "The punches were all right, that I hadn't missed any punches. I punched every half hour from 6 o'clock until 3 o'clock, which was the last punch I made. I don't know whether they took out that slip or not." On Tuesday night, April 29th, at about 10 o'clock, I had a conversation at the station house with Mr. Frank. They handcuffed me to a chair. They went and got Mr. Frank and brought him in, and he sat down next to the door. He dropped his head and looked down. We were all alone. I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, it's mighty hard for me to be handcuffed here for something I don't know anything about," end quote. He said, quote, "What's the difference? They have got me locked up and a man guarding me," end quote. I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, do you believe I committed that crime?" end quote. And he said, quote, "No, Newt, I know you didn't, but I believe you know something about it," end quote. I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, I don't know a thing about it, no more than finding the body," end quote. He said, quote, "We are not talking about that now. We will let that go. If you keep that up, we will both go to hell," end quote. Then the officers both came in. When Mr. Frank came out of his office that Saturday, he was looking down and rubbing his hands. I have never seen him rubbing his hands that way before. End quote. When defense attorney Rosser cross-examined Lee, the witness said that the locked double doors inside the entrance to the building were unlocked when he came back. Next, the prosecution called to the stand Sergeant L.S. Dobbs. He testified, quote, "On the morning of April 27th, about 3:25, a call came from the pencil factory that there was a murder up there. We went in Boots Rogers' automobile, and when we arrived, the door was locked. We knocked, and in about 2 minutes, the Negro came down the steps and opened the door and said a woman was murdered in the basement. We went through a scuttle hole, a small trap door. The Negro led the way back in the basement about 150 feet to the body. The girl was lying on her face, not directly lying on her stomach, with the left side up just a little. We couldn't tell by looking at her whether she was white or black, only by her golden hair. They turned her over, and her face was full of dirt and dust. They took a piece of paper and rubbed the dirt off her face, and we could tell then that it was a white girl. I pulled up her clothes and could tell by the skin of the knee that it was a white girl. Her face was punctured, full of holes, and swollen and black. She had a cut on the left side of her head as if she had been struck, and there was a little blood there. The cord was around her neck, sunk into the flesh. She also had a piece of her underclothing around her neck. The tongue was protruding just the least bit. The cord was pulled tight and had cut into the flesh and tied just as tight as it could be. The underclothing around the neck was not tight. There wasn't much blood on her head. It was dry on the outside. I stuck my finger under the hair and it was a little moist. This scratch pad was lying on the ground close to the body. I found the notes under the sawdust lying near the head. The pad was lying near the notes. They were all right close together. End quote. On cross-examination, Dobbs testified, quote, Newt Lee told us it was a white woman. There was a trash pile near the boiler where this hat was found and paper and pencils down there, too. The hat and shoe were on the trash pile. Everything was gone off it, ribbons and all. The place where I thought I saw someone dragged was right in front of the elevator directly back. The little trail where I thought showed the body was dragged went straight on down where the girl was found. It was a continuous trail. It looked like she had been dragged on her face by her feet. I thought the places on her face had been made by dragging. That was a dirt floor with cinders on it scattered over the dirt. Back door was shut, staple had been pulled. The lock was locked still. It was a sliding door with a bar across the door, but the bar had been taken down. It looked like the staple had been recently drawn. I was reading one of the notes to Lee with the following words, quote, A tall black Negro did this. He will try to lay it on the night, end quote. And when I got to the word night, Lee says, quote, That means the night watchman, end quote. On Dorsey's redirect examination, Dobbs testified that, quote, A man couldn't get down that ladder with another person. It is difficult for one person to get through that scuttle hole. The back door was shut. Staple had been pulled. The sign of dragging started east of the ladder. A man going down the ladder to the rear of the basement would not go in front of the elevator where the dragging was. The body was cold and stiff. Hands folded across the breast. I didn't find any blood on the ground or on the sawdust around where we found the body. End quote. Further redirect examination revealed that Dobbs had found the handkerchief on a sawdust pile about 10 feet from the body. When he was shown the handkerchief on recross examination, he stated, quote, It was bloody, just as it is now. End quote. Later recalled for the state, Dobbs revealed that, quote, The trapdoor leading up from the basement was closed when we got up there. End quote. City Officer John N. Starnes was the next important state's witness. He testified, quote, I reached the factory between 5 and 6 o'clock on April 27th. I called up the superintendent, Leo Frank, and asked him to come right away. He said he hadn't had any breakfast. He asked where the night watchman was. I told him to come, and if he would come, I would send an automobile for him. I didn't tell him what had happened, and he didn't ask me. When Frank arrived at the factory, a few minutes later, he appeared to be nervous. He was in a trembling condition. Lee was composed at the factory. He never tried to get away. End quote. That first morning of the trial, Starn stated that, quote, I saw splotches that looked like blood about a foot and a half or 2 feet from the end of the dressing room, some of which I chipped up. It looked like splotches of blood and something had been thrown there and in throwing it had spread out and splattered. I chipped 2 places off the back door which looked like they had bloody fingerprints. It takes not over 3 minutes to walk from Marietta Street at the corner of Forsyth across the viaduct and through Forsyth Street down to the factory. End quote. Starnes further testified, quote, I could not give the words of the telephone conversation between me and Frank because I could be mistaken as to the words he used. End quote. Concerning the splotches, he said, quote, I don't know if they were blood. End quote. Another witness, W.W. Boots Rogers, testified, quote, "After Starnes' telephone conversation, John Black and I went to Frank's residence, where Mrs. Frank answered the door. Mr. Black asked, quote, 'Is Frank in?' End quote. Mr. Frank stepped into the hall through the curtain partly dressed and asked if anything happened at the factory. When Mr. Black didn't answer, Mr. Frank said, quote, 'Did the night watchman call up and report anything to you?' End quote. Mr. Black then asked him to finish dressing and go to the factory to see what had happened. Frank said that he thought he dreamt in the morning, about 3 o'clock, about hearing the telephone ring. Frank seemed to be extremely nervous and was rubbing his hands and asked for a cup of coffee. After we got in the automobile, one of the officers asked Frank if he knew a little girl named Mary Fagan. Frank asked, quote, 'Does she work at the factory?' End quote. Then I said, quote, 'I think she does,' end quote. And Frank stated, quote, 'I cannot tell whether she works there or not until I look at my payroll book. I know very few of the girls that work there. I pay them off, but I very seldom go back in the factory.' End quote. Frank's references to not knowing Mary Fagan were later to take on added significance. Quote, "We went to the undertaking establishment, but I did not see Frank look at the corpse. I did see him step away into a side room. After the morgue, we went to the pencil factory where Frank opened the safe, consulted his time book, and said, quote, 'Yes, Mary Fagan worked here. She was here yesterday to get her pay. I will tell you about the exact time she left here. My stenographer left about 12 o'clock, and a few minutes after she left, the office boy left, and Mary came in and got her pay and left.' End quote. He then wanted to see where the girl was found. Mr. Frank went around to the elevator where there was a switch box on the wall and put the switch in. The box was not locked. As to what Mr. Frank said about the murder, I don't know that I heard him express himself, except down in the basement. The officer showed him where the body was found, and he made the remark that it was too bad or something like that." End quote. On recross examination, Rogers stated that, quote, "No one could have seen the body at the morgue unless he was somewhere near me. I was inside, and Mr. Frank never came into that little room where the corpse lay." End quote. On redirect examination, he stated that, quote, "When the face was turned toward me, Mr. Frank stepped out of my vision in the direction of Mr. Giesling's sleeping room." End quote. John Black was sworn and stated, quote, "We didn't know it was a white girl or not until we rubbed the dirt from the child's face and pulled down her stocking a little piece. The tongue was not sticking out. It was wedged between her teeth. She had dirt in her eye and mouth. The cord around her neck was drawn so tight it was sunk in her flesh, and the piece of undershirt was loose over her hair. She was lying on her face with her hands folded up. One of her eyes was blackened. There were several little scratches on her face. A bruise on the left side of her head, some dry blood in her hair. There was some excrement in the elevator shaft. When we went down on the elevator mashed it. You could smell it all around." End quote. He had come with Boots Rogers to Frank's residence. Quote, "Mrs. Frank came to the door. She had on a bathrobe. I stated that I would like to see Mr. Frank, and about that time, Mr. Frank stepped out from behind a curtain. Frank's voice was hoarse and trembling and nervous and excited. He looked to me like he was pale. He seemed nervous in handling his collar. He could not get his tie tied and talked very rapid in asking what had happened. He kept insisting on a cup of coffee. When we got into the automobile, Mr. Frank wanted to know what had happened at the factory, and I asked him if he knew Mary Fagan, and told him she had been found dead in the basement. Mr. Frank said he did not know any girl by the name of Mary Fagan, that he knew very few of the employees." End quote. This was the second time, according to testimony at the trial, that Frank had denied knowing Mary Fagan. Quote, "In the undertaking establishment, Mr. Frank looked at her. He gave a casual glance at her and stepped aside. I couldn't say whether he saw the face of the girl or not. There was a curtain hanging near the room, and Mr. Frank stepped behind the curtain. Mr. Frank stated, as we left the undertaker's, that he didn't know the girl, but he believed he had paid her off on Saturday. He thought he recognized her being at the factory Saturday by the dress that she wore. At the factory, Mr. Frank took the slip out, looked over it, and said it had been punched correctly. On Monday and Tuesday following, Mr. Frank stated that the clock had been mispunched 3 times. I saw Frank take it out of the clock and went with it back toward his office. When Mr. Frank was down at the police station, on Monday morning, Mr. Rosser and Mr. Haas were there. Mr. Haas stated, in Frank's presence, that he was Frank's attorney. This was about 8 or 8:30 Monday morning. That's the first time he had counsel with him. On Tuesday night, Mr. Scott and myself suggested to Mr. Frank to talk to Newt Lee. They went into a room and stayed about 5 or 10 minutes alone. I couldn't hear enough to swear that I understood what was said. Mr. Frank said that Newt Lee stuck to the story that he knew nothing about it. Mr. Frank stated that Mr. Gant was there on Saturday evening, and that he told Lee to let him get the shoes, but to watch him as he knew the surroundings of the office. End quote. After this conversation, Gant was arrested. Quote, Mr. Frank was nervous Monday. After his release, he seemed very jovial. On Tuesday night, Frank said at the station house that there was nobody at the factory at 6 o'clock but Newt Lee, and that Newt Lee ought to know more about it, as it was his duty to look over the factory every 30 minutes. End quote. On cross-examination, Black said, quote, after the visit to the morgue, the party went to the factory where Frank got the book, ran his finger down until he came to the name of Mary Fagan, and said, quote, yes, this little girl worked here, and I paid her $1.20 yesterday. End quote. Quote, we went all over the factory. Nobody saw that blood spot that morning. End quote. Frank's attorney, Mr. Haas, told Black to go out to Frank's house and search for the clothes he had worn the week before and his laundry as well. Frank went with them and showed them the dirty laundry. Black went on. Quote, I examined Newt Lee's house. I found a bloody shirt at the bottom of a clothes barrel there on Tuesday morning about 9 o'clock. End quote. On redirect examination by Dorsey, Black stated that Frank said, quote, after looking over the timesheet and seeing that it had not been punched correctly, that it would have given Lee an hour to have gone out to his house and back. End quote. The next person to take the stand had been arrested by the police in their preliminary investigation of the murder. J.M. Gant testified that he was shipping clerk at the pencil factory and that Frank discharged him on April 7th for an alleged shortage in the payroll. Quote, I have known Mary Fagan since she was a little girl, and Mr. Frank knew her too. One Saturday afternoon, she came in the office to have her time corrected by me, and after I had gotten through with her, Mr. Frank came in and said, quote, you seem to know Mary pretty well. End quote. On 2 occasions, after Gant was discharged, he went back to the factory where he said, quote, Mr. Frank saw me both times. He made no objections to my going there. One girl used to get the pay envelope for another with Frank's knowledge. End quote. Gant swore that Mr. Frank discharged him because he refused to make good the $2 shortage in the payroll, which he said he knew nothing about. He then described Frank's behavior Saturday when he went for his shoes. Quote, I stood at the front door, and when Frank saw me, he kind of stepped back, like he was going to go back, but when he looked up and saw I was looking at him, he came on out and I said, quote, howdy, Mr. Frank, end quote, and he sort of jumped again. I asked permission to get my shoes. Frank hesitated, inquired the kind of shoes, was told they were tans, and stated that he thought he had a Negro sweep them out. I said I left a black pair as well, and Frank studied a little bit, and told Newt to go with me and stay with me till I got my shoes. Mr. Frank looked pale, hung his head, and kind of hesitated and stuttered, like he didn't like me in there somehow or another. End quote. On cross-examination, Gant revealed that when he testified at the coroner's inquest, he did not testify about Frank having known Mary Fagan very well. Mrs. J.R. White, whose husband worked at the factory, testified that she went to the factory at 11:30 to see her husband and stayed until 11:50. She returned about 12:30, and she said, quote, "Mr. Frank was in the outside office, standing in front of the safe. I asked him if Mr. White had gone back to work. He jumped like I surprised him, and turned and said, quote, yes, end quote. I then went upstairs to see Mr. White. At about 1 o'clock, Frank came up to the fourth floor and told me that if I wanted to get out by 3 o'clock, I had better come down as he was going to leave the factory and that I had better be ready to leave as soon as he got his coat and hat. As I was going down the steps, I saw a Negro sitting on a box close to the stairway on the first floor. Mr. Frank did not have his coat or hat on when I passed out." End quote. In a later statement, about which there was much conjecture, Mrs. White swore, quote, "I saw a Negro sitting between the stairway and the door, about 5 or 6 feet from the foot of the stairway. I wouldn't be able to identify him." End quote. Harry Scott was sworn in. Quote, "I am the superintendent of the local branch of the Pinkerton Detective Agency and work with John Black, city detective. I was employed by Frank for the National Pencil Company. On Monday, April 28th, I witnessed, along with Mr. Darley and a third party, Frank telling his detailed accounts of his movements the Saturday before. He told of going to Montauk and the coming of Mrs. White to the factory." End quote. Scott related that Frank said that Mary Fagan came into the factory at 12:10 p.m. to draw her pay. She had been laid off the Monday previous, and she was paid $1.20. Quote, "He paid her off in his inside office, where he was at his desk, and when she left his office and went into the outer office, she had reached the outer office door leading into the hall and turned around to Mr. Frank and asked if the medal had come yet. Mr. Frank replied that he didn't know. Mary Fagan, he thought, reached the stairway, and he heard voices, but he couldn't distinguish whether they were men or girls talking." End quote. Harry Scott's next words about Leo Frank created a stir in the courtroom. Quote, "He, Frank, stated during our conversation with him that Gant knew Mary Fagan very well, that he was familiar and intimate with her. He seemed to lay special stress on it at the time. He said that Gant paid a good deal of attention to her. As to whether anything was said by any attorney of Frank's as to our suppressing any evidence as to this murder, it was the first week in May when Mr. Pierce and I went to Mr. Herbert J. Haas's office in the 4th National Bank building and had a conference with him as to the Pinkerton Agency's position in the matter. Mr. Haas stated that he would rather we would submit our reports to him first before we turned it over to the police and let them know what evidence we had gathered. We told him we would withdraw before we would adopt any practice of that sort, that it was our intention to work in hearty cooperation with the police. I saw the place near the girls' dressing room on the office floor. Fresh chips had already been cut out of the floor." End quote. After Frank was arrested, Scott asked Frank to see if he could use his influence with Newt Lee, since he was his employer, and try to get Lee to tell what he knew. Lee and Frank were put in a private room and, quote, "When about 10 minutes was up, Mr. Black and I entered the room and Lee hadn't finished his conversation with Frank and was saying, quote, 'Mr. Frank, it is awful hard for me to remain handcuffed to this chair,' end quote. And Frank hung his head the entire time the Negro was talking to him. And finally, after about 30 seconds, he said, quote, 'Well, they have got me too,' end quote. After that, we asked Mr. Frank if he had gotten anything out of the Negro, and he said, quote, 'No, Lee still sticks to his original story,' end quote. Mr. Frank was extremely nervous at that time. He was very squirmy in his chair, crossing one leg after the other, and he didn't know where to put his hands. He was moving them up and down his face, and he hung his head a great deal of the time while the Negro was talking to him. He breathed very heavily and took deep swallows and hesitated somewhat. His eyes were about the same as they are now. That interview between Lee and Frank took place shortly after midnight, Wednesday, April 30th. On Monday afternoon, Frank said to me that the first punch on Newt Lee's slip was 6:33 p.m., and his last punch was 3 a.m., Sunday. He didn't say anything at that time about there being any error in Lee's punches. Mr. Black and I took Mr. Frank into custody about 11:30 a.m., Tuesday, April 29th. His hands were quivering very much. He was very pale. On Sunday, May 3rd, I went to Frank's cell at the jail with Black, and I asked Mr. Frank if, from the time he arrived at the factory from Montauk Brothers up until 12:50 p.m., the time he went upstairs to the fourth floor, was he inside of his office in the entire time, and he stated, quote, yes, end quote. Then I asked him if he was inside his office every minute from 12 o'clock until 12:30, and he said, quote, yes, end quote. I made a very thorough search of the area around the elevator and radiator and back in there. I made a surface search. I found nothing at all. I found no ribbons or purse or pay envelope or bludgeon or stick. I spent a great deal of time around the trap door, and I remember running the light around the doorway right close to the elevator, looking for splotches of blood, but I found nothing. End quote. When Luther Rosser questioned him, Scott admitted that he did not give the defense attorney the details in his reports of Mr. Frank's movements, about his statement about Gant being familiar with Mary Fagan, and told the attorney that he did not hear Lee, but stated now that he did hear the last words of Lee and the description of Frank's extreme nervousness. After Lee, the next damaging testimony was given by Montine Stover, a pretty girl with dark hair who was about the same age as Mary Fagan. Her allegations contradicted Frank's claim about being in his office continually. Mrs. Stover swore, quote, I worked at the National Pencil Company prior to April 26, 1913. I was at the factory at 5 minutes after 12 on that day. I stayed there 5 minutes and left at 10 minutes after 12. I went there to get my money. I went in Mr. Frank's office. He was not there. I didn't see or hear anybody in the building. The door to the metal room was closed. I had on tennis shoes, a yellow hat, and a brown raincoat. I looked at the clock on my way up. It was 5 minutes after 12, and it was 10 minutes after 12 when I started out. I had never been in his office before. The door to the metal room is sometimes open and sometimes closed. End quote. On cross-examination, she revealed, quote, I didn't look at the clock to see what time it was when I left home or when I got back home. I didn't notice the safe in Mr. Frank's office. I walked right in and walked right out. I went right through into the office and turned around and came out. I didn't notice how many desks were in the outer office. I didn't notice any wardrobe to put clothes in. I don't know how many windows are in the front office. I went through the first office into the second office. The factory was still and quiet when I was there. I am 14 years old and I worked on the fourth floor of the factory. I knew the paying off time was 12 o'clock on Saturday and that is why I went there. They don't pay off in the office, you have to go up to a little window they open. End quote. Albert McKnight, the husband of Frank's cook, Manola McKnight, whose statement to the police concerning Frank's condition the night of the murder had further aroused police suspicions of Frank, testified that, quote, between 1 and 2 o'clock on Memorial Day, I was at the home of Mr. Frank to see my wife. He came in close to 1:30. He did not eat any dinner. He came in, went to the sideboard of the dining room, stayed there a few minutes, and then he goes out and catches a car. Stay there about 5 or 10 minutes. End quote. On cross-examination, McKnight stated that he saw Frank in the mirror in the corner and that you could look through the mirror and see in the sitting room and in the dining room. He did not see the Seligs, but heard Mr. Selig talking, and he did not see Mrs. Frank or Mrs. Selig through the mirror. He couldn't tell who was in the dining room without looking through the mirror. Miss Helen Ferguson, a friend of the murdered girl, testified that she saw, quote, Mr. Frank Friday, April 25th, about 7 o'clock in the evening, and asked for Mary Fagan's money. Mr. Frank said, quote, I can't let you have it, end quote. And before he said anything else, I turned around and walked out. I had gotten Mary's money before, but I didn't get it from Mr. Frank, end quote. On cross-examination, Miss Ferguson stated that she had gotten Mary's money before, and she did not remember if Mr. Schiff was in the office or not when she asked Frank for Mary's money, and that it had been some time since she asked for Mary's pay by number. Three medical experts were sworn in. Doctors Claude Smith, J.W. Hurt, and F.H. Harris had very different contentions about the question of Mary Fagan's rape. All agreed there had been a savage struggle after which the girl was strangled. According to the undertaker, W.H. Giesling, quote, there was a 2 1/2-inch wound on the back of the victim's head, exposing part of the skull. Her hair was clotted with blood, and a tight cord indenting the flesh was drawn around the neck. Blood, urine, and some discharge stained her panties, which had been cut or torn at the seam. End quote. The county physician, Dr. J.W. Hurt, testified, quote, the head wound was induced by a blunt-edged instrument and occurred before death. She died of strangulation. End quote. Although Dr. Hurt said he found blood on her genitals, he contended there was no evidence of violence to the vagina. This finding was in direct contradiction to that of Dr. H.F. Harris, the medical examiner. He stated, quote, besides a ruptured hymen, Mary Fagan's vagina showed evidence of violence before death due to the internal bleeding. The epithelium was pulled loose from the inner walls and detached in some places, end quote. Dr. Harris stated that this violence occurred before death. Nowhere in the testimony can it be found that Mary Fagan was bitten on her breast, although the report of such a bite surfaced many years later when, in 1964, Pierre von Possen, who had studied the evidence and x-rays of the Frank case in 1922, reported that he found x-ray pictures showing the girl had been bitten on the left shoulder and neck before strangulation, and that, moreover, those indentations did not correspond to the x-rays of Leo Frank's teeth. Having examined Mary's stomach contents, Dr. Harris asserted that she had eaten her last meal of bread and cabbage approximately 1/2 to 3/4 of an hour before she died. C.B. Dalton, the man whom Jim Conley alleged brought women, with Leo Frank, to the factory for immoral purposes, took the stand. Quote, I know Leo M. Frank, Daisy Hopkins, and Jim Conley. I have visited the National Pencil Company 3, 4, or 5 times. I have been in the office of Leo M. Frank 2 or 3 times. I have been down in the basement. I don't know whether Mr. Frank knew I was in the basement or not, but he knew I was there. I saw Conley there and the night watchman, and he was not Conley. There would be some ladies in Mr. Frank's office. Sometimes there would be 2 and sometimes 1. Maybe they didn't work in the mornings and they would be there in the evenings. End quote. Later, on cross-examination, he mentioned Daisy Hopkins again. Quote, I don't recollect the first time I was in Mr. Frank's office. It was last fall. I have been down there 1 time this year, but Mr. Frank wasn't there. It was Saturday evening. I went in there with Miss Daisy Hopkins. I saw some parties in the office, but I don't know them. they were ladies. Sometimes there would be two and sometimes more. I don't know whether it was the stenographer or not. I don't recollect the next time I saw him in his office. I never saw any gentleman but Mr. Frank in there. Every time I was in Mr. Frank's office was before Christmas. Miss Daisy Hopkins introduced me to him. I saw Conley there one time this year and several times on Saturday evenings. Mr. Frank wasn't there the last time. Conley was sitting there at the front door. When I went down the ladder, Miss Daisy went with me. We went back by the trash pile in the basement. I saw an old cot and a stretcher. End quote. On redirect examination, Dalton stated that, quote, Frank had Coca-Cola, lemon and lime, and beer in his office. End quote. When recross-examined, he admitted that he had served time in the chain gang in 1894 for stealing. But he claimed in later redirect testimony that it had been almost 20 years since he had been in trouble. Mel Stanford, who had worked for Frank for 2 years, testified that he swept the whole floor in the metal room on Friday, April 25th. Quote, On Monday thereafter, I found a spot that had some white Haskellene over it on the second floor near the dressing room that wasn't there Friday when I swept. The spot looked to me like it was blood with dark spots scattered around. End quote. On cross-examination, Stanford said that he, quote, moved everything and swept everything. I swept under Mary's and Barrett's machine. End quote. Finally, it was the testimony of the state's star witness, Jim Conley, a short, stocky black man who was a sweeper at the factory, that stunned the jury with his findings. He testified, quote, I had a little conversation with Mr. Frank on Friday, the 25th of April. He wanted me to come to the pencil factory that Friday morning, that he had some work on the third floor he wanted me to do. Friday evening, about 3 o'clock, Mr. Frank came to the fourth floor, where I was working, and said he wanted me to come to the pencil factory on Saturday morning at 8:30, that he had some work for me to do on the second floor. I had been working for the pencil company a little over 2 years. I got to the pencil factory about 8:30 on April 26th. Mr. Frank and me got to the door at the same time. Mr. Frank walked to the inside and I walked behind him and he says to me, quote, Good morning, end quote. And I says, quote, Good morning, Mr. Frank, end quote. He says, quote, You are a little early this morning, end quote. And I says, quote, No, sir, I am not early, end quote. He says, quote, Well, you are a little early to do what I wanted you to do for me, and I want you to watch for me like you have been doing the rest of the Saturdays, end quote. I always stayed on the first floor like I stayed the 26th of April and watched for Mr. Frank, while he and a young lady would be up on the second floor chatting. I don't know what they were doing. He only told me they wanted to chat. When young ladies would come there, I would sit down at the first floor and watch the door for him. I couldn't exactly tell how many times I have watched the floor for him previous to April 26th. It has been several times that I watched for him, but there would be another young man, another young lady, during the time I was at the door. A lady for him and one for Mr. Frank. Mr. Frank was alone there once. That was Thanksgiving Day. I watched for him. Yes, a woman came there Thanksgiving Day. She was a tall, heavy-built lady. I stayed down there and watched the door just as he told me the last time, April 26th. He told me when the lady came he would stomp and let me know that was the one, and for me to lock the door. Well, after the lady came and he stomped for me, I went and locked the door as he said. He told me when he got through with the lady he would whistle and for me then to go and unlock the door. That was last Thanksgiving Day, 1912. On April 26th, me and Mr. Frank met at the door. He says, quote, What I want you to do is to watch for me today as you did other Saturdays, end quote. And I says, quote, All right, end quote. I said, quote, Mr. Frank, I want to go to the Capital City Laundry to see my mother, end quote. And he said, quote, By the time you go to the laundry and come back to Trinity Avenue, stop at the corner of Nelson and Forsyth Street until I go to Montague's." End quote. I don't know exactly what time I got to the corner of Nelson and Forsyth Streets, but I came there sometime between 10 o'clock and 10:30. I saw Mr. Frank as he passed by me. I was standing on the corner. He was coming up Forsyth Street toward Nelson Street. He was going to Montague's factory. While I was there on the corner, he said, quote, "Ha-ha, you are here, is yer?" End quote. And I says, quote, "Yes, sir, I am right here, Mr. Frank." End quote. He says, quote, "Well, wait until I go to Mr. Sigg's. I won't be very long. I'll be right back." End quote. I says, quote, "All right, Mr. Frank, I'll be right here." End quote. I don't know how long he stayed at Montague's. He didn't say anything when he came back from Montague's, but told me to come on. Mr. Frank came out Nelson Street and down Forsyth Street towards the pencil factory, and I followed right behind. As we passed up there, the grocery store, Albertson Brothers, a young man was up there with a paper sack getting some stuff out of a box on the sidewalk, and he had his little baby standing by the side of him, and just as Mr. Frank passed by him, I was a little behind Mr. Frank, and Mr. Frank said something to me, and by him looking back at me and saying something to me, he hit up against the man's baby, and the man turned around and looked to see who it was, and he looked directly in my face, but I never did catch the idea what Mr. Frank said. Mr. Frank stopped at Curtis's Drugstore, corner of Mitchell and Forsyth Street, went into the soda fountain. He came out and went straight on to the factory, me right behind him. When we got to the factory, we both went on the inside, and Mr. Frank stopped me at the door, and when he stopped me at the door, he put his hand on the door and turned the door and says, quote, "You see, you turn the knob just like this, and there can't nobody come in from the outside," end quote. And I says, quote, "All right," end quote. And I walked back to a little box back there by the trash barrel. He told me to push the box up against the trash barrel and sit on it, and he says, quote, "Now, there will be a young lady up here after a while, and me and her are going to chat a little," end quote. And he says, quote, "Now, when the lady comes, I will stomp like I did before," end quote. And he says, quote, "That will be the lady, and you go and shut the door," end quote. And I says, quote, "All right, sir," end quote. And he says, quote, "Now, when I whistle, I will be through. So you can go and unlock the door, and you come upstairs to my office then, like you are going to borrow some money from me, and that will give the young lady time to get out," end quote. I says, quote, "All right, I will do just as you say," end quote. And I did as he said. Mr. Frank hit me a little blow on my chest and says, quote, "Now, whatever you do, don't let Mr. Darley see you," end quote. I says, quote, "All right, I won't let him see me," end quote. Then Mr. Frank went upstairs and he said, quote, "Remember to keep your eyes open," end quote. And I says, quote, "All right, I will, Mr. Frank," end quote. And I sat there on the box, and that was the last I seen of Mr. Frank until up in the day sometime. The first person I saw that morning after I got in there was Mr. Darley. He went upstairs. The next person was Miss Mattie Smith. She went on upstairs. Then I saw her come down from upstairs. Miss Mattie walked to the door and stopped, and Mr. Darley comes on down to the door where Miss Mattie was, and he says, quote, "Don't you worry. I will see that you get that next Saturday," end quote. And Miss Mattie came on out and went up Alabama Street, and Mr. Darley went back upstairs. Seemed like Miss Mattie was crying. She was wiping her eyes when she was standing down there. This was before I went to Nelson and Forsyth Street. After we got back from Montague Brothers, the first person I saw come along was a lady that worked on the fourth floor. I don't know her name. She went on up the steps. The next person that came along was the Negro drayman. He went on upstairs. He was a peg-legged fellow, real dark. The next, I saw this Negro and Mr. Holloway coming back down the steps. Mr. Holloway was putting on his glasses and had a bill in his hands, and he went out towards the wagon on the sidewalk. Then Mr. Holloway came back up the steps. Then after Mr. Darley came down and left, Mr. Holloway came down and left. Then this lady that worked on the fourth floor came down and left. The next person I saw coming there was Mr. Quinn. He went upstairs, stayed a little while, and then came down. The next person that I saw was Miss Mary Perkins, that's what I call her, this lady that is dead. I don't know her name. After she went upstairs, I heard footsteps going towards the office, and after she went in the office, I heard two people walking out of the office and going like they were coming down the steps, but they didn't come down the steps, they went towards the metal department. After they went back there, I heard the lady scream, then I didn't hear no more, and the next person I saw coming in there was Miss Montine Stover. She had on a pair of tennis shoes and a raincoat. She stayed there a pretty good while. It wasn't so very long either. She came back down the steps and left. After she came back down the steps and left, I heard somebody from the metal department come running back there upstairs on their tiptoes. Then I heard somebody tiptoeing back towards the metal department. After that, I dozed off and went to sleep. Next thing I knew, Mr. Frank was up over my head stamping, and then I went and locked the door and sat on the box a little while, and the next thing I heard was Mr. Frank whistling. I don't know how many minutes it was after that I heard him whistle. When I heard him whistling, I went and unlocked the door just like he said and went up the steps. Mr. Frank was standing up there at the top of the steps and shivering and trembling and rubbing his hands like this. He had a little rope in his hands and a long, wide piece of cord. His eyes were large, and they looked right funny. He looked funny out of his eyes. His face was red. Yes, he had a cord in his hands just like this here cord. After I got up to the top of the steps, he asked me, quote, "Did you see that little girl who passed here just a while ago?" End quote. And I told him I saw one come along there, and she come back again. And then I saw another one come along there, and she hasn't come back down. And he says, quote, "Well, that one you say didn't come back down. She come into my office a while ago and wanted to know something about her work in my office, and I went back there to see if the little girl's work had come, and I wanted to be with the little girl, and she refused me, and I struck her, and I guess I struck her too hard, and she fell and hit her head against something, and I don't know how bad she got hurt. Of course, you know I ain't built like other men." End quote. The reason he said that was, I had seen him in a position I haven't seen any other man that has got children. I have seen him in the office 2 or 3 times before Thanksgiving, and a lady was in his office, and she was sitting down in a chair, and she had her clothes up to here, and he was down on his knees, and she had her hands on Mr. Frank. I have seen him another time there in the packing room with a young lady lying on the table. She was on the edge of the table when I saw her. He asked me if I wouldn't go back there and bring her up so that he could put her somewhere, and he said to hurry that there would be money in it for me. When I came back there, I found the lady lying back flat on her back with a rope around her neck. The cloth was also tied around her neck, and part of it was under her head like to catch blood. I noticed the clock after I went back there and found the lady was dead and came back and told him. The clock was 4 minutes to 1. She was dead when I went back there, and I came back and told Mr. Frank the girl was dead, and he said, quote, "Shh, shh," end quote. He told me to go back there by the cotton box, get a piece of cloth, put it around her, and bring her up. I didn't hear what Mr. Frank said, and I came on up there to hear what he said. He was standing on the top of the steps, like he was going down the steps, and while I was back in the metal department, I didn't understand what he said, and I came back there to understand what he did say, and he said to go and get a piece of cloth to put around her, and I went and looked around the cotton box and got a piece of cloth and went back there. The girl was lying flat on her back, and her hands were out this way. I put both of her hands down, they went down easily, and rolled her up in the cloth, and taken the cloth and tied her up, and started to pick her up, and I looked back a little distance and saw her hat and piece of ribbon laying down and her slippers, and I taken them and put them all in the cloth, and I ran my right arm through the cloth and tried to bring it up on my shoulder. The cloth was tied just like a person that was going to give out clothes on Monday. They get the clothes and put them on the inside of a sheet and take each corner and tie the 4 corners together, and I run my right arm through the cloth after I tied it that way and went to put it on my shoulder, and I found I couldn't get it on my shoulder. It was heavy, and I carried it on my arm the best I could. And when I got away from the little dressing room that was in the metal department, I let her fall, and I was scared, and I kind of jumped. And I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, you will have to help me with this girl. She is heavy," end quote. And he came and caught her by the feet, and I laid hold of her by the shoulders. And when we got her that way, I was backing, and Mr. Frank had her by the feet. And Mr. Frank kind of put her on me. He was nervous and trembling. And after we got her a piece from where we got her at, he let her feet drop, and then he picked her up, and we went on the elevator, and he pulled down on one of the cords, and the elevator wouldn't go, and he said, quote, "Wait, let me go in the office and get the key," end quote. And he went in the office and got the key and come back and unlocked the switch box, and the elevator went down the basement, and we carried her out, and I opened the cloth and rolled her out there on the floor, and Mr. Frank turned around and went on up the ladder, and I noticed her hat and slipper and a piece of ribbon, and I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, what am I going to do with these things?" end quote. And he said, quote, "Just leave them right there," end quote. And I take in the things and pitches them over in front of the boiler. And after Mr. Frank had left, I goes on over to the elevator, and he said, quote, "Come on up, and I will catch you on the first floor," end quote. And I got on the elevator and started it onto the first floor, and Mr. Frank was running up there. He didn't give me time to stop the elevator. He was so nervous and trembly, and before the elevator got to the top of the first floor, Mr. Frank made the first step onto the elevator, and by the elevator being a little down like that, he stepped down on it and hit me quite a blow right over about my chest. And that jammed me up against the elevator, and when we got near the second floor, he tried to step off before it got to the floor, and his foot caught on the second floor as he was stepping off, and that made him stumble, and he fell back sort of against me. And he goes on and takes the keys back to his office and leaves the box unlocked. I followed him into his private office, and I sat down, and he commenced to rubbing his hands and began to rub back his hair, and after a while he got up and said, quote, "Jim," end quote. And I didn't say nothing. And all at once he happened to look out of the door, and there was somebody coming, and he said, quote, "My God, here is Emma Clark and Corinthia Hall," end quote. And he said, quote, "Come over here, Jim. I have got to put you in this wardrobe," end quote. And he put me in this wardrobe, and I stayed there a good while, and they come in there, and I heard them go out, and Mr. Frank come there and said, quote, "You are in a tight place," end quote. And I said, quote, "Yes," end quote. And he said, quote, "You done very well," end quote. So after they went out, and he had stepped in the hall and had come back, he let me out of the wardrobe, and he said, quote, "You sit down," end quote. And I went and sat down, and Mr. Frank sat down. But the chair he has was too little for him, or too big, or it wasn't far enough back or something. He reached on the table to get a box of cigarettes and a box of matches, and he takes a cigarette and a match, and hands me the box of cigarettes, and I lit one and went to smoking, and I handed him back the box of cigarettes, and he put it back in his pocket, and then he took them out again and said, quote, "You can have these," end quote. And I put them in my pocket, and then he said, quote, "Can you write?" end quote. And I said, quote, "Yes, sir, a little bit," end quote. And he'd taken his pencil to fix up some notes. I was willing to do anything to help Mr. Frank because he was a white man and my superintendent. And he sat down and I sat down at the table, and Mr. Frank dictated the notes to me. Whatever it was, it didn't seem to suit him, and he told me to turn over and write again. And I turned the paper and wrote again. And when I'd done that, he told me to turn over again, and I wrote on the next page there. And he looked at that and kind of liked it, and he said that was all right. Then he reached over and got another piece of paper, a green piece, and told me what to write. He took it and laid it on his desk and looked at me smiling and rubbing his hands, and then he pulled out a nice little roll of greenbacks, and he said, quote, "Here is $200, end quote. And I taken the money and looked at it a little bit, and I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, don't you pay another dollar for that watchman, because I will pay him myself," end quote. And he said, quote, "All right, I don't see what you want to buy a watch for either. That big fat wife of mine wanted me to buy an automobile, and I wouldn't do it." End quote. And after a while, Mr. Frank looked at me and said, quote, "You go down there in the basement, and you take a lot of trash, and burn that package that's in front of the furnace." End quote. And I told him, all right. But I was afraid to go down there by myself, and Mr. Frank wouldn't go down there with me. He said, quote, "There's no need of my going down there." End quote. And I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, you are a white man, and you done it, and I am not going down there and burn that myself." End quote. He looked at me, then kind of frightened, and he said, quote, "Let me see that money." End quote. And he took the money back and put it back in his pocket, and I said, quote, "Is this the way you do things?" End quote. And he said, quote, "You keep your mouth shut. That is all right." End quote. And Mr. Frank turned around in his chair and looked at the money, and he looked back at me and folded his hands and looked up and said, quote, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn." End quote. And he looked down when he said that, and I looked up at him, and he was looking up at the ceiling, and I said, quote, "Mr. Frank, what about me?" End quote. And he said, quote, "That's all right. Don't you worry about this thing. You just come back to work Monday like you don't know anything and keep your mouth shut. If you get caught, I will get you out on bond and send you away." End quote. And he said, quote, "Can you come back this evening and do it?" End quote. And I said, quote, "Yes, I was coming to get my money." End quote. He said, quote, "Well, I am going home to get dinner, and you come back here in about 40 minutes and I will fix the money." End quote. And I said, quote, "How will I get in?" End quote. And he said, quote, "There will be a place for you to get in, all right, but if you are not coming back, let me know, and I will take those things and put them down with the body." End quote. And I said, quote, "All right, I will be back in about 40 minutes. End quote. Then I went down over to the beer saloon across the street, and I took the cigarettes out of the box, and there was some money in there, and I took that out, and there was 2 paper dollar bills in there, and 2 silver quarters, and I took a drink, and then I bought me a doubleheader and drank it, and I looked around at another colored fellow standing there, and I asked him, did he want a glass of beer, and he said, quote, "No," end quote. And I looked at the clock, and it said 2:20, and the man in there asked me, was I going home, and I said, quote, "Yes," end quote. And I walked south on Forsyth Street to Mitchell, and Mitchell to Davis, and I said to the fellow that was with me, quote, "I am going back to Peter Street," end quote. And a Jew across the street that I owed a dime to called me and asked me about it, and I paid him that dime. Then I went on over to Peter Street and stayed there a while. Then I went home, and I taken 15 cents out of my pocket and gave a little girl a nickel to go and get some sausage, and then I gave her a dime to go and get some wood, and she stayed so long that when she came back, I said, quote, "I will cook this sausage and eat it and go back to Mr. Frank's," end quote. And I laid down across the bed and went to sleep, and I didn't get up no more until 6:30 that night. That's the last I saw of Mr. Frank that Saturday. I saw him next time on Tuesday on the 4th floor when I was sweeping. He walked up and he said, quote, "Now remember, keep your mouth shut," end quote. And I said, quote, "All right," end quote. And he said, quote, "If you'd come back on Saturday and done what I told you to do with it down there, there wouldn't have been no trouble," end quote. This conversation took place between 10 and 11 o'clock Tuesday. Mr. Frank knew I could write a little bit because he always gave me tablets up there at the office so I could write down what kind of boxes we had, and I would give that to Mr. Frank down at his office, and that's the way he knew I could write. I was arrested on Thursday, May 1st. Mr. Frank told me just what to write on those notes there. The girl's body was lying somewhere along there about number 9 on that picture. End quote. States Exhibit A. Quote, "I dropped her somewhere along number 7. We got an elevator on the 2nd floor. The box that Mr. Frank unlocked was right around here on side of the elevator. He told me to come back in about 40 minutes to do that burning. Mr. Frank went in the office and got the key to unlock the elevator. The notes were fixed up in Mr. Frank's private office. I never did know what became of the notes. I left home that morning about 7 or 7:30. I noticed the clock when I went from the factory to go to Nelson and Forsyth Streets. The clock was in a beer saloon on the corner of Mitchell Street. It said 9 minutes after 10. I don't know the name of the woman who was with Mr. Frank on Thanksgiving Day. I know the man's name was Mr. Dalton. When I saw Mr. Frank coming towards the factory Saturday morning, he had on his raincoat and his usual suit of clothes and an umbrella. Up to Christmas, I used to run the elevator. Then they put me on the fourth floor to clean up. I cleaned up twice a week on the first floor under Mr. Holloway's directions. The lady I saw in Mr. Frank's office Thanksgiving Day was a tall-built lady, heavyweight. She was nice-looking. She had on a blue-looking dress with white dots on it and a graying-looking coat with kind of tails to it. The coat was open like that, and she had on white slippers and stockings. On Thanksgiving Day, Mr. Frank told me to come to his office. I have never seen any cot or bed down in the basement. I refused to write for the police the first time. I told them I couldn't write. End quote. Defense attorney Rosser spent 3 days attacking Conley's testimony. Conley never changed his story and cheerfully admitted to having lied on numerous occasions, including those statements submitted to police prior to his full confession in late May. Conley also admitted to a number of arrests that had resulted in fines of nominal amounts for drunkenness or disorderly conduct, and one sentence of 30 days for an altercation with a white man. Rosser was able to show that Conley had a poor memory about everything except the murder, and was repeatedly denounced by those who knew him as, quote, "dirty, filthy, black, drunken, lying nigger," end quote. Those who believe Leo Frank guilty of the murder of Little Mary Fagan are convinced that Jim Conley could not have possibly fabricated the involved, detailed account of what had happened, as well as withstood the hours of cross-examination. O.B. Keeler, a native Mariettan, reporter and journalist who covered the trial for the Atlanta Georgian, claimed it would have been impossible for Conley to invent such testimony, and the Atlanta Constitution reported, quote, "No such record has ever been made in a criminal court case in this country. Conley may be telling the truth in the main, or he may be lying altogether. He may be the real murderer, or he may have been an accomplice after the fact. Be these things as they may, he is one of the most remarkable Negroes that has ever been seen in this section of the country. His nerve seems unshakable. His wit is ever ready." As hour by hour the attorneys for the defense hammered away and failed to entrap the Negro, the enormity of the evidence became apparent. Finally came the virtual confession of the defense that they had failed to entrap the Negro, and they asked that the evidence be stricken from the records. The Negro withstood the fire, and Frank's attorneys are seeking to have the evidence expunged from the records. End quote. As I continued to read the evidence, I realized that the long litany of witnesses called by the state was to be superseded only by the long litany of witnesses called by the defense. Indeed, some witnesses seemed to be called by the wrong side. One state witness, Holloway, gave testimony which supported defense contentions. Holloway testified, quote, "I am the day watchman for the factory, and I forgot to lock the elevator on Saturday when I left at 11:45. End quote. He admitted that he had previously sworn twice that he did leave the elevator locked. Once in the affidavit he gave to Solicitor General Dorsey and at the coroner's inquest. On cross-examination, he stated, quote, "Frank got back from Montauk's at about 11 o'clock, and he was in his office on the books. When I was leaving at 11:45, I saw Corinthia Hall and Emma Clark were coming toward the factory. I had seen blood spots on the floor, but I did not remember having seen the blood spots Barrett found." End quote. Holloway went on, quote, "I have never seen Frank speak to Mary Fagan." End quote. Further, he said, quote, The cords like that used to strangle Mary Fagan could be found all over the place. They came on the bundles of slats that are tied around the pencils. It was Barrett who discovered the blood, hair, and pay envelope. End quote. His explanation of the difference between his former testimony about the elevator and that at the trial was, quote, "I sawed a plank for Mr. Denham and Mr. White on the fourth floor and forgot about it. When I remembered that I saw the plank, I recollected that I had forgotten to lock the elevator." End quote. Despite these few contradictions at this point, I could not help feeling that my family's assessment of Leo Frank's guilt was true. But I turned my attention to the defense's case and promised myself I would be fair in assessing the evidence.